Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Valentine's Day has become an annual reminder of the need to pay attention to heart disease. It's a major killer, the leading cause of death among American men and women. It is largely preventable, though, and treatable. Joining me in studio to talk about heart disease and what we can do to lessen the risks associated with it is cardiologist Dr. Andrew Cates, professor of medicine with the Washington University Heart Care Institute at Barnes Jewish Hospital. Doctor, nice to have you back again.
Thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure to be here.
As I said earlier, if it's February, it must be Andy Cates Day.
That's right. But again, Cates, thanks for having me here.
Pleasure. Well, you know, I start the program every time we do it this way, I think, and that is, since we spoke last year at this time, has there been anything that has significantly changed the whole heart healthcare picture?
Well, so I think as a means of review, and as you said, we try to start off with kind of talking about what's new. It's helpful to remind everybody also what's old out there too, and realizing the statistics are still fairly impressive. We're doing a better job in treating cardiovascular disease and preventing it, but we're still certainly not succeeding as much as we'd like. And to remind everybody that if we think about cardiovascular disease, first of all, it includes conditions such as coronary heart disease, stroke, heart failure, peripheral vascular disease. As you said, it's the leading cause of death. One out of three individuals die from cardiovascular disease. That's nearly 800,000 deaths annually. And it's really that accounts for more than all causes of cancer and COPD and other lung diseases combined. So it's certainly an incredibly important problem. As far as treatment that we have and as conditions or as options that we have and as we evolve and as we continue to try to prevent and then treat cardiovascular disease, there's a lot of things that are out there that we're doing. We're seeing newer classes of agents becoming available for treating cholesterol, for treating heart failure, for treating diabetes and cardiovascular complications from diabetes, seeing new techniques for treating valvular heart disease. So as we work on prevention, primary prevention, we're also working on secondary prevention. So a lot of exciting things that are out there.
But with the progress you've just cited with medications and what have you, the mortality rate is still
there. Right. It's still far higher than we need to be. And it's important to understand, too, that we talk about prevention of cardiovascular disease. And as you said, there are many things that we can do to help ourselves out. So we think about risk factors. There are those modifiable risk factors that we can treat. There are those non-modifiable that we can't. But we think about modifiable risk factors such as hypertension or diabetes or high cholesterol or smoking. There are things that one can do to help prevent those conditions from developing in the first place, so-called primordial prevention. And then once those conditions are established, treating those conditions to prevent the progression to cardiovascular disease, which is primary prevention.
It would seem to me then that step one would have to be education. People have to know what these things that they can do are.
That's right. So, and if we think about how to prevent the development of these conditions, we talk about one of the most important things are lifestyle changes, lifestyle modifications. So if we think about that, then we take into account factors such as diet and exercise. And we know that diet is very important. And I get asked by many patients what a healthy diet is. And there's no magic bullet to this. I mean, a lot of times just be thinking about what you think would be healthy and a well-balanced diet is key. Actually, what's important is I encourage my patients to meet with a dietitian to really go through in a methodical manner just what constitutes a heart-healthy diet with a balance of proteins, carbohydrates, and fats, the healthy fats versus the unhealthy fats, and caloric monitoring and so forth.
Well, while there's no magic bullet with regard to what is good for us, there is certainly a lot of information out there as to what is bad, and Americans seem really hooked on a lot of the bad stuff.
And we see that. You know, we think about for diet and for smoking as well, which we can talk about a little bit later, but when we think about diet, the things that one should avoid, there's a lot of challenges that we face. You know, we see on a daily basis as adults and as children what our kids are exposed to with dietary selections, the high fat content foods. We see the high caloric contents. We see now with labeling of food products and restaurants, we can see what the caloric content is. And I think people get a better appreciation for just how many calories they're consuming. And monitoring caloric consumption can be beneficial for individuals as well.
Are there any indications out there that people are really becoming aware of the dangers of certain things that we have so much of in our diet. And I'm thinking of red meat, for instance, as being one, and a lot of the sauces and things you find in fast foods.
Yeah, so we have seen that. We have seen a shift in dietary patterns in individuals as education has improved. And I think we can look towards the caloric monitoring. We can look towards potential changes in food labeling as well with the specific contents to help educate individuals. So I think we have seen some changes. I think we have a long way to go in really affecting change more, though.
Another thing that we have talked about in the past, but it's certainly worth repeating because obviously it's very important, and that is heart disease in women. Still, I think that most people don't think that that's an issue.
And that's something that I definitely wanted to talk about today as well, too. We do know that women and heart disease is an incredibly important topic. It's the leading cause of death in women, and actually more women than men die annually from cardiovascular disease. As a matter of fact, actually last Friday was just go red for heart disease around the country, and at WashU, we took advantage of that. We had our faculty and our staff wear red appropriately for heart disease awareness. Raising awareness is key. For the longest time, it was presumed and felt that cardiovascular disease was a disease for men, and we know that's just not the case. We know that the risk factors in women play an important role as well. We know that smoking and diabetes have a clear influence on the incidence of cardiovascular disease in women, and raising awareness is so important as well. And it's interesting that despite cardiovascular disease and heart disease being the leading cause of death in women, when asked, more women identify cancer, breast cancer specifically, as their main health concern. And that's not to minimize the importance of awareness for breast cancer, but I think it's to reemphasize the importance of education that's involved in making the understanding, appreciating the importance of cardiovascular disease in women.
There's a marketing issue here, which relates to education, and not to minimize the breast cancer issue, but they've done a really, really good job in making the people aware of the
issue. And that's why, if we look, there are a lot of initiatives that are out there for women and heart disease, but also just on the larger scale for all of us in raising awareness for heart disease, from the American Heart Association, from the American College of Cardiology, a lot of different initiatives that are targeted at reducing the incidence of cardiovascular disease. We think about things like Heart Healthy 2020, which is through the American Heart Association with a goal of reducing the incidence of cardiovascular disease by 20% by 2020. There's another initiative called 25 by 25, which is a global initiative to reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease and other non-communicable diseases by 25% by 2025. So a lot of things that are out there to really raise this awareness and push people to live more healthy.
Another of the issues that I've seen in getting ready for this program is the fact that apparently African Americans are at greater risk. I think I'm putting it properly. They're at greater risk for heart disease for some reason.
Right, and we see that, and that's a good point to bring up as well. We do see the risk related to cardiovascular disease in both in Hispanics and in African Americans related to exposure to risk factors. We know that hypertension is an incredibly important problem for many Americans, but especially in African American population. We know that the risk of diabetes is important as well, and a lot of it relates, especially to the issue related to hypertension. And an area that's very important to many of us is healthcare disparity or healthcare inequity, and raising awareness for disparities that exist for access to healthcare and delivery of healthcare to individual communities, individual populations, is something that's very important, especially as we target cardiovascular disease.
I've made many references on this program to the For the Sake of All report that came out here in St. Louis, which shows that disparity. Mm-hmm. Sometimes as much as an 18-year difference in life expectancy in certain zip codes related directly to poverty, and as you indicate, that
and some of it relates to access to health care, some of it relates to other issues, other respects of health care as well.
What about demographically? Has there been any shift in regard to the age at which people are experiencing heart issues?
So a good question to ask. You know, we do know that the incidence of cardiovascular disease goes up as we get older. It's interesting. As we've done a better job in treating many different cancers, we find that more people were developing cardiovascular disease or dying from cardiovascular disease primarily because people were living longer. So it will get you eventually. As far as the age in which we see the onset, we do know that it becomes more frequent as people get older. And there has been a slight shift to diagnosis as people get older.
Yeah. But I recall, and this doesn't go back necessarily too far, that autopsies on young people who have died suddenly have shown really disturbingly high levels of blockage in arteries and that sort of thing, which shouldn't be happening at teenagers, for instance.
And so then, and the question I think that you're asking is, right, when do we see the development of cardiovascular disease? So we can see in younger individuals with various risk factors, we can see the development of cardiovascular disease, atherosclerotic disease, and you were alluding to autopsy studies that were done, I think, more in the 1970s and 80s even, that demonstrated atherosclerotic plaque in young individuals. That alludes to, and something that's worth talking about, is the incidence of childhood obesity, and that incidence has been increasing over the course of the last 10 to 15 years. And with that, there is a greater risk for development of cardiovascular disease in younger individuals.
Yeah. There is much to talk about, needless to say, on this particular subject, and we have a number of people who want to weigh in. I'd like to take a call from Jay calling from Normandy right now because it relates directly to what we've just been talking about. So let's take Jay's call. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Doctor. I read in the newspaper that sugar is apparently a bigger cause of heart disease than they used to think of in the 60s and 70s, that saturated fat used to be the big thing. But now sugar might be equally so. Your comments?
So, Jay, that's a good question to ask. You know, the challenge has been, I think when some of the dietary guidelines came up many years ago, there were recommendations made really regarding fat and cholesterol as the main issue. And there has been some controversy over why those recommendations were made related to potentially actually some conflicts that those people who published those studies may have had. So with that, as you may know, that there really were no specific dietary recommendations for the amount of sugars that should be consumed. So I think we've come to appreciate better the importance of sugar and the risk of developing diabetes and other cardiovascular conditions. And because of that, sugar has gained additional importance. I think we've also come to appreciate the benefits of the so-called healthy fats. And there's been this shift now to where encouraging consumption of the so-called healthy fats is more important. So again, along those lines, I think we've reassessed and reevaluated the risk related to sugar in the diet and elevated that, understanding that some of the previous data that had been out there may have been a little bit less clear.
So can I ask you this? If a person is of normal and has good normal physical activity and has pretty good cholesterol readings, is it still okay to have an occasional piece of cake, pie, et cetera?
Of course. So this is, you know, it's been said by somebody a lot smarter than me, everything in moderation, including moderation. No, of course. I mean, I think this is where one has to understand that, you know, having modest consumption of sugars is not unreasonable, I think is the best thing to say. I have patients ask me frequently for dietary recommendations and if they can or cannot have a piece of cake or, you know, have a glass of wine or something like that. It's certainly okay if, as you said, if you're otherwise healthy, you know, if you're a diabetic, certainly there may be issues that come into play. But no, I think it's certainly reasonable to enjoy a piece of cake every now and then.
But not all sugars are found in cakes and candy.
That's
foods that have sugar in it, we don't even know it perhaps.
Right, and so that gets to the issue related to especially, of not reading the label or eating out, you know, certainly in restaurants too, not appreciating some of those hidden sugars, the hidden calories that we see. And it's important to remember too that, you know, back in the 80s with the low-fat craze that was out there, people fell in love with the idea of having a low-cholesterol, low-fat diet, and they forgot that sugar makes food taste good or salt makes food taste good, and those foods are very high in those in that. And so you had significant caloric content because of that.
We have to take a break. We'll do that now and come back and take more questions for Dr. Andy Cates and also from you in the audience. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. Send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org, or if you'd prefer to send a tweet, do so at STL on air. Andy Cates is with the Washington University Heart Care Institute at Barnes Jewish Hospital. He's also a professor of medicine. Back in a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Dr. Andy Card. I'm going to go right back to the phones because I think Bill in Overland has a question relating to the sugar. I hope it's not repetitive, but he brings in corn syrup, I believe, to the equation. Bill, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thanks. Yeah, so I'd heard some bad things about high fructose corn syrup, and oftentimes when I've seen, they lump it in with sugar. And I don't know if there's much research out there teasing out the high fructose corn syrup from the sugar as a risk for heart disease.
Well, that's a good question also. And Bill, honestly, I'm not sure. I mean, I know we think about, as we look at labels and look for the different kind of hidden sugars, as Don alluded to earlier, and high fructose corn syrup is one of those things. I don't know if there's any specific research targeted at that. What I'll say, though, and I'll use your question and the previous caller's question as well, is to reemphasize the importance, I think, of speaking with dietitians when it comes to addressing your risk as related to diet. And I think this is where, as I said, as I meet with patients, they'd like to discuss in 5 minutes what a good diet is for them. And that really does a great disservice to the importance, I think, of diet in our lives and our heart as we address heart disease issues. So I really encourage individuals to meet with a dietitian and talk with them and get a better sense of how these different things would affect them.
While we're on the subject of nutrition, let's bring in Frank calling from St. Louis. He's going to take us a little bit different direction. Go ahead, Frank.
Hi, doctor. My name is Frank. I had a question related to incorporation of coconut and coconut oil in the diet. I understand that both of those have saturated fats, but I'm also told that they're short chains molecules. Just wanted to get your take on, is that something I should be focusing more on or eating less of?
Well, honestly, Frank, again, great questions. I will say that, and I won't put myself out there as an expert related to coconut oil. I do know that in the scheme of oils that we like to think about, we'll take a step back and talk about data that's really available for diet as related to heart health. And we know that the Mediterranean-style diet, which really incorporates more olive oil, flaxseed oil, those type of oils, that shows that there's data with those studies. A study called the Leon Heart Study showed the benefit of the of Mediterranean-style diet, which have different oils than coconut oil. So I don't know for sure with coconut oil what data there may or may not be to say that it's heart healthy. I think in general the consensus is it's not one of the healthier oils. But then if we look at studies that are available, again, a study called the Leon Heart Study or PREDIMED, which looked at, again, the Mediterranean-style diet, there is actually data out there, at least reasonable data, that says that type of diet is beneficial.
It's my impression, Dr. Cates, that we are, as a society, susceptible to fads. And we go through a lot of them, it seems, with regard to what we get. I go back to the Atkins diet, for instance, mm-hmm. which was so popular. And then all of a sudden it's debunked and then maybe even brought back. How do we evaluate these
so
things?
So this is where, again, it's challenging. And what we keep coming back to are the longer-term recommendations for a well-balanced diet. So the American Heart Association has our heart healthy diet that's recommended, the Mediterranean style diet. And those are those diets that really are balanced for protein, carbohydrates, and fats. And if we think about it, when it comes to the use of diet for weight loss, and this is an important topic to discuss too, when we talk about obesity and the epidemic that's obesity, we talk about ways of addressing it. And one of the important ways relates to diet and other lifestyle changes. There are other things besides that, such as drugs that can be used or even bariatric surgery. But when it comes to diet for means of meaningful weight loss, we talk about caloric restriction. We talk about a diet that's sustainable. And the challenge with things like the Atkins diet or some of the liquid diets or other fad diets, as you had said, the challenge with those types of diets is they're not sustainable. And we see with individuals is once they lose a significant amount of weight, they go back to some of those old habits, and then they regain the weight. And what's important also for individuals that are interested in weight loss is really choosing a diet that's balanced, but also choosing a realistic goal for weight loss. And in general, we advise patients to target a pound a week. And that's typically limiting, if you count your calories, 350 calories a day. Limiting 500 calories a day. And that translates to a pound a week and losing, again, methodically. And that's key.
That brings us back to the nutritionist, which some people mm-hmm. might say, who can afford that? But if you see something that looks too good to be true, you want to try it. Check with the nutritionist
first.
That's
what talking to our dietitian. Talking to the registered dietitian is so important because he or she can really go into depth and take a deep dive with you and come up with a dual plan.
Sure. Another call. This time Sandra joins us from Bridgeton. Go ahead, Sandra. You're on the air.
Thank you. Something I want to bring up is that sometimes the very first sign that anything's wrong is the heart attack that kills you. My husband had a complete panel workup 6 months prior because he was increasing his life insurance. Nothing showed up, not one thing. And he'd been to the doctor that afternoon for infected poison ivy. She didn't hear anything untoward. And then 1:30 in the morning, he has a heart attack. He was 50 years old. I am told that it is dubbed the widowmaker because it's the type of heart attack where if you're not already in the hospital, you're not going to survive. And he survived about 24 hours before the lack of oxygen shut down his brain, shut down his internal organs.
Sandra, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry for you and for your family. You bring up such an important point, and this is where coming back to what Don and I were talking about before is reinforcing the importance of prevention and the challenges that many people don't have symptoms. As you said, it sounds, he never had any symptoms beforehand, and we know that almost 2/3 of people who die suddenly from cardiovascular disease, from a heart attack, don't have symptoms beforehand. So this is where trying to do our best to treat those risk factors. And screening helps to some degree, but screening patients who have no symptoms with stress testing is something that has never shown to be helpful. And we struggle with that because we'd like to do our best to make sure nobody dies from a heart attack suddenly like your husband did, but we don't screen people routinely who don't have symptoms because it really hasn't been shown to be helpful. Screening meaning with stress tests. The things that we think about for people that die suddenly or that have coronary disease and don't have risk factors, we think about genetic concerns. Yep. There's a new movement out there called precision medicine, which really kind of aims to target therapies and target evaluations to individuals at higher risk based upon genetic profiling, for lack of a better word. And that can be helpful for some. And this is also where, coming back again, maybe not for your husband but for others, knowing what risk factors are, knowing if you have high cholesterol, knowing if you have hypertension, if you smoke, or if you have diabetes, knowing what those risk factors are, knowing your numbers, and doing your best to be aggressive about that.
Sandra, are you still there?
Yes, and I'd like to bring up one more thing.
Sure.
Is there was probably a genetic thing that we didn't realize was a genetic thing. His paternal grandfather died before his father was born of a stroke. Now, his father did have a heart attack at 50, but the guy smoked like crazy and drank and everything, so we connected it to that, not to, wait a minute, quadruple bypass surgery at 50, died of a stroke at 50, maybe we better look at something genetic. Yeah. It just didn't register.
And you do bring up a good point that even, you know, with family history, we do look for early coronary artery disease or cardiovascular disease in first-degree relatives, or in his father or sibling or mother. And that's things that we look for to try to help us better help our patients.
That is a very strong component. You hear about it frequently. I'm sure you more than I, yeah, of people who die suddenly.
And I do see I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, just who die suddenly and whose father died suddenly, that sort of thing.
And this is where I see a lot of patients for evaluation for cardiovascular risk assessment because they're concerned that their brother, their sister, their mother, father died early. And it's important to remember that when we talk about early heart disease, we talk about a heart attack or stroke typically before 55 or 65, depending upon if it's a man or a woman. And that's part of the equation, especially if there's multiple family members affected. And Sandra, as you said, it's tough to know, especially if we try to dismiss it to smoking or other exposures. And the challenge is that not everybody who has, everybody who has risk factors has a strong family history and vice versa. Certainly knowing those risk factors and, again, knowing if there's a family history at least should lead us to be a little bit more cognizant.
What about symptoms? What should people be looking for, alerted to, or concerned about?
So this is where being aware first if you have the risk factors and then certainly if you have risk factors, knowing about symptoms. And when we think about symptoms of heart disease, the classic description would be chest pain or chest pressure or tightness, sometimes a burning in the chest. Symptoms can involve, they radiate up to the jaw, across your chest. They can sometimes be a little less specific than that. They can be sometimes indigestion symptoms. Typically, and we think about women, sometimes have less common symptoms. Sometimes it can be fatigue or, again, indigestion symptoms. Classically, these symptoms are exertional. So I don't want our viewers, our listeners to think that if they're having some indigestion symptoms after they eat that that's heart disease, but certainly being aware of it. But also, again, realizing they're usually exertional in nature. They can sometimes be progressive. The symptoms of a heart attack can be different than the symptoms just of coronary disease. The symptoms of a heart attack typically can be pain like that, but it doesn't go away. Mm-hmm. So pain in your chest or burning or chest tightness that starts at rest and just doesn't go away, that may be a heart attack. Symptoms that you may have if you're walking your dog or if you're riding a bike or exercising, symptoms of chest discomfort that goes away as you stop doing that activity, that certainly should raise concern and have you talk with your doctor or your healthcare provider.
And if you're having some of these symptoms, should you chew a couple of aspirin before calling the doctor?
You know, I think it's probably reasonable to do that. So if you think you're having a heart attack, and again, to be clear and differentiate, we're talking about a heart attack versus having coronary disease. Coronary disease in individuals may manifest just as symptoms that begin somewhat gradually and may require attention, but necessarily an ER visit. That's different than having a heart attack. And if you think you're having a heart attack, such as, again, chest discomfort that just doesn't go away, diaphoresis, so if you're sweating, you feel like you're going to throw up, things like that, those people, chewing an aspirin may be helpful. Really calling 911, calling EMS, being assessed rapidly, being brought to an ER and being evaluated. It's important, and I re-educate patients on this who don't call EMS, to realize that you can be evaluated. Sometimes therapy beyond just aspirin, nitroglycerin can be administered. Sometimes even other important medications can be started en route. They can notify the ER. You can be seen emergently, be taken to a cardiac catheterization lab if necessary on an emergent basis. And you get seen a lot more quickly coming in. And even more importantly, an unfortunate number of patients who drive themselves or have a loved one drive them to the ER don't make it there because they die suddenly. And had they been with in an ambulance, they could have been shot. They could have been defibrillated or shocked. More could have been done. So I really encourage any of you who think you're having a heart attack to take advantage of our EMS system and call them. And that's the best thing to do.
Just a word or two about medications here. You say there are some new things on the horizon and actually are out there now. But a question that always comes up in these conversations concerns statins.
Sure.
And they're controversial. Not everybody believes that they're
– Yeah, and I get asked this a lot too. And, yeah. And I think if one takes a step back and looks at the data that's available, there shouldn't be much controversy around the use of statins. So when it comes to treating cholesterol or treating patients with cardiovascular disease or patients at high risk for cardiovascular disease, it's undeniable the data that suggests that statins are the best means of reducing the risk of either a first heart attack or stroke for certain individuals or recurrent heart attack or stroke. If you're a diabetic, if you have atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, if you have a very high cholesterol level, or if your risk is very high based upon multiple risk factors, the data is really clear that statins are the best way of preventing cardiovascular complications. Now, the challenge that comes up is that there are potential side effects that one can encounter. The main concern really relates to muscle symptoms, and about 1 out of 10 individuals do develop muscle symptoms related to statin therapy. It's usually reversible and can be done away with multiple different ways. The risk of liver problems is really so low that we no longer check liver enzymes routinely. Yeah. And there are some other concerns that individuals have too. I encourage you to talk with your doctor or your advanced healthcare provider about those concerns and learn.
All right. I'm going to take another quick call from Yuri, calling from St. Louis. But make it quick, Yuri, if you would. We're running out of time.
Hello, this is Gary. Is this my turn to speak?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that one reason, I think people focus too much on diets for weight loss, It's about activity levels. And I think that as a society, we need to have a discussion about the right kind of PE classes in school. I'm a physician, too. I know it'd be ridiculous to give amoxicillin to a cancer patient. We'd be giving a drug, but not the right drug. Similarly, with PE, we're not doing the right kind of PE. Lifetime fitness depends on flexibility, aerobic power, and strength. And the PE classes should focus on teaching kids how their weight is when a weight room, how to be flexible with classes like yoga, lifelong activities like walking and running.
Yuri, we've got the idea. Time is running away from us. I'm going to have the doctor respond to you.
No, that's great. No, again, I think you're getting to the idea of education for diet, for exercise. All this stuff starts at an early age and getting our young listeners, I hope, to realize the importance of a heart healthy diet, of exercise, and you know, Don and I were just talking about this beforehand too, the importance of actually enjoying exercise. And for kids, if it's considered punishment, it's not going to help them longer term. They really do need to understand the importance. And Gary, maybe what you're alluding to is giving them lifetime exercise teaching. So thank you for a good point brought up.
Also, we just have a very limited amount of time left, but it seems that kids are getting less PE in school these days, particularly in the lower grade levels, which is not good with the obesity problem.
I think you're right. So getting kids to get out there and exercise more, we do that with our kids.
A final question here we had from one of our producers is pointing to Debbie Reynolds and Carrie Fisher and their loss within 24 hours or whatever it was. Is it possible to die of a broken heart?
So it is. The broken heart, there's a condition called a stress-induced cardiomyopathy. Now, I think Debbie Reynolds also was older and had
sure. –
and it was very sad. We were all very sad with Carrie Fisher dying. But the broken heart syndrome is a condition called a stress-induced cardiomyopathy or Takotsubo cardiomyopathy that one can have in the setting of emotional stress. So it is possible.
It can happen. Yeah. Going to have to bring it right there, Dr. Andrew Cates, Washington University cardiologist. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's great to be here. Thanks again. Thanks for having me back. I really, really enjoyed being here with you today.
Thank you. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.